number 20. So I'm going to add a couple questions, and we still have plenty of time for audience questions. What do you think Congress should do to improve the U.S. economy?
I don't know if anybody remembers 2008, but both Barack and Hillary campaigning furiously in the Rust Belt of the Northeast. Oh, we're going to, you know, we're going to stand up for you. So we got out of NAFTA, right? Oh, no, wait a minute. Late last year, now we have this new free trade pact with Korea and Panama and Colombia, where, you know, in Colombia, where 98 trade unions were slaughtered recently, and Korea, we're going to lose another 151,000 jobs, and God knows how many hundreds of thousands of tax shelters in Panama. We have lost 5 million manufacturing jobs because of NAFTA over the last 15 years. 50,000 factories have shut their doors. We've lost one-third of our manufacturing base. You need, I'm asking you to work with me, to send a troublemaker, an effective troublemaker, who's going to say, no, Barack, no, enough is enough. Because I don't know if you listen to Tom Hartman, he's one of the top progressive radio talk show hosts in the country. He wrote a book about rebuilding the country, 11 Ways to Reboot the United States. He points out that in 1981, we were the biggest exporter of manufactured goods in the country, on the planet. We were the biggest importer of everybody else's raw materials. And we were the biggest creditor in the world. Now, in 2012, well, he wrote the book last year, we're the biggest exporter of our own raw materials to other countries. We're the biggest importer of everybody else's manufactured goods. And we're the biggest debtor on the planet. If you want more of the same old, somebody who's going to be go along, get along, talking about on fracking, well, I don't see a lot of space between the president's position and mine. No, Barack Obama is wrong to promote hydrofracking. No, Barack Obama is wrong to promote free trade. That's not the change we can believe in. That's not transformational. 10 years ago, Barack Obama said he was for single payer. That's what he told the Illinois AFL-CIO Central Labor Congress. FDR said, make me do it. You have an opportunity here in the 19th Congressional District. You have an opportunity. I talk about a grassroots campaign. I tell you what, 6 weeks ago, we launched an Otsego County headquarters. The whole county is covered with phone calls. We are making miracles happen on a shoestring. The front page of the Kingston Times is all about Ken Tyner catch Shriveman. Why does it say that? We got a little bit of momentum. With one-tenth of this man's money, we got the Big Mo. I'm not saying that we have Big Mo endorsing us, Maurice Hinchy. But we got momentum. We can do this. It's up to you.
Thanks. Let's actually focus on the question that's critical to the folks who are here in these communities, and that's getting the economy going again. I have had the opportunity to travel around the entire district over the past several weeks, the past few months, and talk to many people who are in an economy that is providing anxiety and uncertainty, where jobs are uncertain, when we're still living in a time when an illness could mean losing a home, or an illness could mean losing your child's college fund. Congress can take one big step to improving the economy for everyone by changing the way that it thinks about the economy. We need an economy that thinks about what is good for the American worker first and foremost. So what does that mean? Number one here, that means focusing on our local economies, building on the strengths that we have here. More and more, what I hear from our small business owners and our farmers is that the reason Washington doesn't work for them is that it listens only to the loudest and biggest voice that's in its ear. It listens to the noise from the lobbyists and the corporations that have all of the advantages and can take those advantages. And so what does that mean? It means our small businesses lose funding for rural broadband, lose access to capital because the congressman has voted against both of those, and instead we give tax credits to companies that ship jobs overseas. It means we lose that manufacturing base. It means we reward companies that are seeing record profits while cutting jobs with allowing them to pay no income tax. We need a focus on a congressman who goes to Washington and says, what is right and fair? How do we make a fair economy? Not with a tax code that continues to reward only the most wealthy folks and pushes the burden onto us. So we need to end the Bush tax cuts on the wealthiest Americans. We need to end those tax breaks for the companies that are sending jobs offshore. And we need absolutely fair trade, not unregulated free trade. The negotiated agreements that we have been reaching in the past several years have spent too little effort ensuring that there are environmental and labor protections in the countries that we propose to deal with. And as a result of that, we harm our entire environment globally. We hurt the human rights of workers overseas while losing jobs here in America. So we absolutely need a greater focus on fair trade, properly protected trade agreements, rules and regulations that work for the little folks that run their small businesses and their farms, because in this district we have only family farms, not agribusiness, and turn the focus away from only the loudest. I take with tremendous seriousness and responsibility that I will be a voice for an extraordinarily rural community, and that's the voice that needs to be heard there. Thank you.
Hey, we heard by indirection some comments about healthcare and the current concerns about healthcare in the country. I know there are concerns, serious concerns about the healthcare policy and finance in this community. There's a dependency of U.S. Supreme Court decision that could halt or even reverse the president's, the recently passed healthcare legislation. I'd ask each candidate to talk about their point of view about the current healthcare policy and what alternatives they would advance or recommend, or whether they're supportive of the policy as adopted. I'll start with Mr. Schreiber for 2 minutes.
Thank you. I support absolutely universal access to good quality health care. That is the objective that we on our side of the fence have been working for so long, and that we have finally made some steps to achieving. So let's be clear about the current health care plan. It was supported by doctors and nurses and hospitals and opposed by the big insurance companies. I trust doctors and nurses to know what's right for our health care system. And having recently been endorsed by the American Nurses Association, I'm pleased to say that they know that I know what's right for that system and will work hard for it. That is not to say by any means that the so-called Obamacare plan is perfect. But what stage we are at right now is defending this achievements that we've made in the past few years. Congressman Gibson has voted to allow health insurance companies to discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. He would put us back to a time, and has voted to do so, when young people in an economy where it's so hard for young people to get a job can't remain on their parents' insurance through the age of 26. So we need to absolutely defend the achievements that we have while continuing to work toward that universal access to health coverage that we also need, so that we, again, do not live in a time when the emergency medical situation leads you to fear losing your home. And part of that is defending the best healthcare insurance system that we have, which is Medicare. I had a very personal experience with Medicare over the last few years of my father's life. And one of the easiest things that we had in what was otherwise a horrible process was to be able to go to any doctor anywhere and say Medicare and move on from there. You check that box and don't worry anymore. And at the same time, one of the worst experiences I had with Medicare was figuring out the prescription drug benefit. I'm being cut off, so I won't go into the details, but I'm sure you all experienced how hard it was to figure out that so-called Republican reform. So, thank you.
Yes. Oops. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, sorry.
Somebody turned it off before I got to me.
Yes, the Obama plan, the Affordable Health Care Act, it's better than nothing. You know, 33 million people getting health insurance coverage is nothing to sneeze at. Kids up to 26, the health insurance coverage facilitated and enabled, pre-existing conditions dealt with. Those are all good things. But again, even after I directly challenged Julian to come out for single payer, he doesn't want to say it. What that means is, and he's singing the praises of Medicare. Medicare is wonderful. That's why everybody should be able to have it. Maurice Hinchey has spent decades standing up and fighting for that. He obviously doesn't want to continue that fight. The torch is not being passed on unless you vote for me and work for me on healthcare issue. 8 years ago, there was an article in The Nation magazine by Morton Mintz, single payer, good for business, talking about economic development again. And again, there's been a sort of a litany of endorsements. I think one of the reasons why I've had a number of folks endorse me is because I am for single payer. I am for bringing back FDR's Glass-Steagall Act. I do agree with Maurice Hinchey on those issues, unlike my opponent. Pete Seeger's endorsed my campaign. Cornell West has endorsed my campaign. Medea Benjamin, Jason West here in New Paltz. Quite a few.
Please try to be responsive to the question on and the time given.
Sure. Can I just ask why Julian was allowed to mention his endorsements numerous times, but you stopped me from mentioning my endorsements?
Well, yes, you can, but I won't answer.
Okay. That was not fair, Mr. Benjamin, seriously.
The fact was that he did that at a time where he was qualifying himself, and he had that discretion. You're doing it at a time where I'm asking you to be specifically responsive to a question. So you're doing it at the wrong time. Additionally, you will have time at the end of the debate to be summative and to talk about your endorsements. So if you'll be tolerant and allow fairness, we'll proceed.
You know, listen, the fix has been in. The fix has been in for this campaign for a long time. I wasn't supposed to be around this long. It's pretty obvious what's going on here. But I'm asking you folks, you know, the other side has a lot of money, but we have the people. Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. With all due respect.
With great frequency, when I look out the window of my office, I see the flag flying at half mast. It's hard for me to allow a debate over accession to a position in Congress where national and international policy is made without asking at least one question about the candidate's attitude toward the role of the United States in the world and their view about the relative success of the current administration, which is an administration of the party they are in and seek to join in Washington if they're elected. Additionally, there is a world crisis in finance that has not been discussed that is fundamentally involving this country and could lead to great difficulty. So I would ask, in general, for 3 minutes on the candidate's attitudes towards the current direction of American foreign policy, with some attention to the United States' involvement in resolution of the world economic crisis we face. Mr. Tyner.
I'm going to share with you folks an open secret. You know, I think a lot of you do listen to Northeast Public Radio, WNC, as I do, and you may have heard Chris Gibson talk about our troops are in too many countries. Now, why am I saying something halfway over? Because you're not stupid. So I think if a Democrat is going to beat Chris Gibson, they cannot afford on a moral level, but also on a political level, I think we need a Democratic candidate who's going to call for all of our troops to come home now. All right, Jeff Cohen has endorsed my campaign. I hope you don't mind me saying that. Well, he spoke in Woodstock on my behalf a couple weeks ago. This country, we have 5% of the world's population, and we spend 50% of the world's military budget. Where's the peace dividend? I've been an activist for 20 years, unlike certain other people. All right. I remember back in the mid-90s, the American Friends Services Committee sending around information about the peace dividend. You know, Barack Obama has escalated the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I never worked for the CIA. Anybody know about the CIA drones in Pakistan that have killed 500 civilians and over 150 children? Do you want to send somebody to Washington who's going to keep their lips zipped about the CIA drones? They're winning friends and influencing people, right? I'm sure they're making those Pakistan folks and Afghanistan folks happy with us, you know, destroying weddings and everything else. All our troops need to come home now. And I'll say something else. I don't know if you've seen the bumper sticker, IRA, not the Irish Republican Army, but IRA, and then the Q is turning to an N. Somebody needs to go to Washington to speak the truth about the Middle East, okay? My brother converted to Judaism. I held the Torah for my niece's bat mitzvah. But guess what? I read Rabbi Michael Lerner's Tikkun magazine. I go to JewishVoiceForPeace.org. And in January, the New York Times in the middle of January, had a piece from the Program on International Policy Attitudes. There was a poll that 65% of Israeli Jews say the entire Middle East should be free of nuclear weapons. That's 65% of Israeli Jews say the entire Middle East should be free of nuclear weapons. And that same poll, Program International Policy Attitudes, University of Maryland, same poll found that 64% of Israeli Jews say the entire Middle East should be free of nuclear weapons, even if that means Israel has to give up its 200 nuclear weapons. Why is Joel bringing that? I'll be honest with you. There's plenty of people on my campaign staff every other week that, Joel, you can't talk about that. I'm talking about it. Because Ulster County just had Rabbi Michael Lerner at the Woodstock congregation a month or two or three ago. It's killing me that I missed it. I am sick and tired of Democrats who read The Nation and read The Progressive and da 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 and all these progressive publications, but you can't speak truth to power. It's not being anti-Israel. It's not being anti-Semitic. It's not being anti-Jew. Two-thirds of Jews in Israel say the center cannot hold. We cannot continue what's going on. Wouldn't it be nice to send somebody to Washington to actually talk about that?
Thanks. It is an important topic, Jerry. And as I mentioned at the outset, my father served in World War II, all of my uncles served in World War II, and I had the opportunity to serve in my own small way as a lawyer at the Central Intelligence Agency, helping bring known terrorists to justice through our civilian courts. So it's an area I've had some experience with and know something about. And the fact is, we are overextended. An area where I disagree with our president, although he's had a number of foreign policy successes, is his continuation of our military presence in Afghanistan. I believe we need to and should end that now and bring our troops home in a safe and orderly fashion as quickly as we can. It's good foreign policy. It's also, by the way, good for the budget. So let's end that and bring that to a conclusion. And let's look everywhere about the emphasis that grew out, especially the Bush administration, of foreign policy only by military. We need all aspects. We need our strong military, but we also need strong diplomacy. And we need to be able to talk to people and be respected. And it is definitely true that dropping bombs from the air on a wedding is the best way to build enemies for America, not a way to make us more secure. But there are other avenues of foreign policy as well that Jerry's question raised and that Mr. Tyner didn't address. There is a significant economic crisis at the water's edge in Europe brewing right now. And it's brewing in large part because Europe has followed the policies that the Republicans would enforce to great extent here in the United States. And if that continent continues to have its economies fail, we can see even greater hardship coming to our shores unless we are vigilant, unless we watch closely what they're doing, learn from it, learn what not to do. And in particular, that means not following more of the Tea Party economic agenda here. So foreign policy, sure, is about wise use and wise non-use of military force. It's also about wise use of economic force when necessary, about standing up for our currency and not allowing other countries to manipulate their currency and harm our job situation. It's about ensuring that when other countries fail to handle their sovereign debt crises, that it doesn't ripple over to America and interfere with our ability to grow. So it's not, you cannot be a one-note person when it comes to foreign policy. You've got to look at the whole picture, understand it, and bring a level-headed and firm approach. That's what I would do.
Thank you. I'd invite the audience to recognize the value of the remarks they heard from these candidates before we proceed, as we reach just about the 1 hour point. So. Now, at this juncture, if there are people who have to leave for some reason, if they could quickly and quietly do that, that would be appropriate. We have two more things to do. We're going to take some questions from the audience, and then we're going to allow 3 minutes each so candidates can bring forward. Did I get that wrong, Kate? 2 minutes each, so the candidates can provide summative remarks of their own choosing and their own emphasis. Having completed this part, Mr. Schreiberman has to leave promptly. I understand Mr. Tyner can. remain only a little longer. Is that
I got all day.
So we will do the questions from the audience at this juncture. I would I think Laura Wall, as she has a microphone, or will have shortly have a microphone. So if you indicate your wish to ask a question by raising your hand, we will bring the mic to you. I will recognize you. Please give your name and your question. Keep your question brief and in the form of a question. Laura, are you ready? Yes, go ahead.
If you wiggle that mic, it makes that loud.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to.
You put it back on it.
They can't, it doesn't work when I put it on. Sorry for this morning. So, the person you're standing behind, yes. Please give your name and ask your question.
Yes, my name is Kelly McKenzie. I have a question for both candidates. If you were elected to Congress, would you either vote for, sponsor, or author legislation to abolish corporate personhood?
The question is, if you were elected to Congress, will you vote for, author, or sponsor legislation to abolish corporate personhood? I'm going to ask Mr. Schreiben to answer first. 2 minutes on this, please.
Thank you. We may be able to do this in less than 2 minutes. Corporate personhood, as it has come to be known and abused by laws in this country, should be ended. There is nothing in the Declaration of Independence, when you speak about the rights of people to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that puts corporations in that category of human beings who are entitled to those rights. So yes, I would absolutely work to curtail the expansion of treating corporations like humans at a time when the Tea Party and other Republicans are not treating humans as well as they should be treated in this country. So we need a policy that focuses on what's good for real working people and not what focuses on what's good for and gives rights to the largest corporations in America. So corporations have their place. I'm not anti-corporation. Corporations have a role in our economy and our business, not a role to have the same rights as human beings have.
Yes, I would. And maybe I shouldn't say this, but I try to be honest with people. About 5 or 6 weeks ago, I heard Julian on WHVW saying very strongly that he would push to amend the Constitution to make it clear that corporations aren't people. I think there's a bunch of progressives in the room. It's like, I don't know why he's running away from that, and I probably shouldn't be saying it, because I'm running as a progressive. But he seems to be running away from that position. If you go to my website, it's duchessdemocracy.blogspot.com. Okay? Go to January 2010. Now, Obama has spoken out against Citizens United. 80% of people in this country, according to a January 2010 poll, ABC News, Washington Post, are opposed to it. We're all opposed to it. But there are fixes. And Maurice Hinchey, right here, has been one of the leaders in this country saying the Constitution needs to be amended. Corporations aren't people. I don't know why we just didn't hear that from Julian. And he said that 5 or 6 weeks ago on WHVW. But that is what it is. Also, we need Clean Money, Clean Elections campaign finance reform. FairElectionsNow.org is the national version of that. Maine and Connecticut, they got something like 70-80% of those state legislators are elected using this system. Truck drivers, waitresses are running for office. Democracy, it's right on those. Kelly, thank you for asking this. It's right on my campaign literature. It's right on my website. And it would really help if the Democratic candidate for Congress was picking up the ball on that and picking up the torch. I would also say, talking about democracy in general, I got on the front page of the Millbrook Independent a couple of months ago on this issue, because I did a press conference in front of Chris Gibson's Red Hook office, challenging him to the same Elizabeth Warren, Scott Brown challenge to limit the influence of super PACs. I would hope that Mr. Schreiben would do that as well. I did a similar press conference in Kingston recently. Nobody covered that. But there's also, just so folks, when we're talking about democracy, you know, people power instead of corporate power, there are some other debates that the AUW has organized this week. I don't see Mr. Schreiben agreeing to those, so.
Over here, Laura Gilbrenner.
Since one of the candidates Is one of the candidates brought
Say
up?
Say your name, sir.
Oh, Gil Brenner. You're both present. Since one of the candidates brought up the Middle East, nuclear-free zone, on July 1st, the European Union is starting to have a total boycott of Iranian oil. This is fairly well known. It's been published in a few places. What would you, since you go to Congress and will deal with international issues, what would happen if the Iranians blocked the Persian Gulf? How would you react?
I'm not sure how I'd react, honestly. And I know that, you know, I'm all about green jobs. I used to be the environmental committee chair for the Dutchess County Legislature before the Tea Party took out half of my colleagues. I pushed for green jobs, zero waste, solar. But the way we are right now, unfortunately, too much of the country runs on oil. I'm not really ready, though, to say, well, we're just going to have to send our troops over there because, you know, does anybody remember this? I hope I'm not the only person who remembers this 5 or 10 years ago. The bumper sticker is pretty widespread and rampant. How did our oil get under their soil? You know what I mean? It's like, it just sort of, you know, I'm not looking to see the world economy crumble or collapse with that, but on the other hand, it doesn't feel right to me to answer then, well, we're just gonna enter World War III. Also, just about the European crisis, I was criticized for not answering the question properly. Germany has not been nice to the rest of Europe as far as forcing austerity down their throats. But if you look at Germany itself, I've actually spoken on the phone with Tom Gagan, who wrote a book called Were You Born on the Wrong Continent. In Germany, the corporations, and there's lots of them that are very successful, the unions directly elect one half of the members of the boards of directors. And the unemployment rate is much, it's at least 1 or 2 percentage points now lower in Germany. It's 6.7% unemployment rate. And they got nice wages, health care, pensions, benefits, because the middle class has not been killed. About a decade ago, I stopped talking about, we got to stop these attacks on the middle class. Because so many people were like, no, Joel, no, there is no middle class anymore. There is no middle class anymore. So I know that's a little bit far afield, but you got me going there.
Okay, I remind the candidates that brief questions will allow more questions to be asked in the limited amount of time, and focused answers will also permit them.
I'll give a focused answer.
Is it your turn? Sorry. Well, that was a great brief answer.
Thoughts for sure. Look, the fact that we have to sit here in rural New York and wonder what will happen to us if Iran blockades a small strait half a world away emphasizes the need to redouble our efforts for alternative and renewable fuels that we have here at home. And I'm absolutely committed to continuing the extraordinary work that Maurice Hinchey has done in this area to nurture solar energy industry here in the Hudson Valley and promote those alternative energies around the United States. I agree that no congressional candidate should be speculating about what to do in a hypothetical crisis 2 years from now. I'm sure that the president at that time, should it happen, will have a response brought that we will consider very closely. The important thing that I think is to remember when we speak about what could happen in that region is to remind ourselves that we are the most powerful nation on Earth with the greatest Army, Navy, Air Force capacity, and that Iran is not a military competitor or a serious military threat to the United States at this time. So it is a tactical circumstance. Obviously, we must never allow Iran to have a nuclear weapons capacity. But when you're talking about a regional conflict there, I know that our country has the capacity to address it. And the issue is, will we address it with the sophistication and sensitivity that the situation will require, or will we be, if Mitt Romney is elected, faced with George Bush Part II of blundering and blustering and threatening to blow anyone up that they can find? Unfortunately, there's that risk, but our president that we have now has shown a steady course, and I think we would see that in a situation like that as well.
Or this...
Hi. I'm DJ Rocher,
co-founder.
There's terror in our midst. could be one of us. Behind you in the line, or beside you on the bus. Wearing camouflage, they might be wearing suits. These terrorists among us might be wearing army boots. These are dangerous times, and people are afraid. No looking back at history to see how enemies were made. Some dictators are bad, some dictators are good. That's a hard one to explain, but I wish somebody would. So let us all agree, let us not dissent. Let us not ask questions such as we are.
Would you still keep funding it given its recent a coup?
So that's a two-part question. Would you answer both parts, Mr. Sharp?
Thank you, Sheila. The issue of whistleblowers and sources is one that I know well as a prosecutor, and frankly, having been in the national security world, you need people who have information, who can right wrongs, to be able to come forward without fear of retribution. It's true in the national political sense, frankly, it's true in the labor organizing sense, where there's a risk of power being used to suppress people's exercise of their rights and liberties. You need to be able to create an environment where folks can come forward and provide that information securely and be able to not fear that they'll be persecuted. I can tell you, unfortunately, you're right. You see a lot of pushback to people who speak truth to power. There was a tremendous amount of corruption, for example, in the Iraq and Afghanistan reconstruction process. And a woman who came forward about that within the structure lost her job and was demoted. So we definitely have to be out of the habit of punishing people who come forward to do things for the betterment of our country and do exactly what you describe, a whistleblowing. At the same time, we also have to understand that leaks cause real harm if done in the wrong way, in the wrong time, and indiscriminately. I spoke to someone here today before the debate started who had a career in our national security realm who was outed while overseas as a result of a book that was published, and whose life was endangered by that. So the delicate balance between the opportunity to speak freely and raise issues about what's wrong and make our country a better place, at the same time is balanced by those rare occasions where folks' lives can be endangered. So to me, you err on the side of whistleblowing, but it is an area you have to tread carefully.
Bradley Manning should get the Nobel Peace Prize. I've been campaigning for this office since last August, and in recognition of the fact that maybe I wouldn't have all the money in the world to do it, so I knew that in order to win a primary, if there was going to be one, that I'd really get supercharged progressive activists to like me and support me all over. So even, I don't know, it was last fall or so, up in, I think it was Albany County, Del Mar perhaps, Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, there was a huge event about Bradley Manning. There's been a national sort of solidarity tour, and I attended that event, actually. And if you go to my website, which is duchessdemocracy.blogspot.com, you can actually see a blog post. So I would tend to agree with the likes of Michael Moore that we need more people like Bradley Manning that are willing to put their lives on the line. So that's that. As far as military aid to countries like Egypt, I'm not in favor of that. There's far too much military aid that our tax dollars have been used for that are just stirring up more trouble and causing more problems. Bradley Manning exposed civilians being killed. Bradley Manning exposed drone strikes, possibly CIA drone strikes. And talking about whistleblowing, I don't know if anybody saw the July 2010 Washington Post poll, the article, Top Secret America. 1,271 government organizations, 1,931 private companies at 10,000 locations in counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence, national security agency intercepting or storing 1.7 billion emails, calls, and texts, 72 fusion centers that can secretly spy on us. I have never worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. I think we need to send people to Washington who unapologetically will promise and vow and make a commitment to be a watchdog on the CIA and the ever-expanding national security state instead of a defender lapdog.
Thank you.
Yes, I promise to recognize this person next. Please.
Lucille Weinstadt is my name. I have a two-part question also. One, what is your feeling about rendition, which is sending suspected terrorists overseas to be tortured because they're not allowed to torture them in this country, so they send them to other countries? That's one question. The other question is the military budget. It's, as Mr. Tyner said, 50% of the world's military budget is the United States. We spend 50% of the money. It's also costing, in my opinion, it's also one of the things that is wrecking the United States economy.
Please form the question.
Okay. What is your opinion on these questions?
There should be no rendition, and I believe the CIA has been involved in that. I never worked for the CIA under President Barack Obama. I never worked for the CIA under George W. Bush, unlike my opponent. And I know that rendition, even a friend of mine from Columbia County has pointed out that rendition has been involved. I think the Washington Post has reported on rendition being involved in an airport in Columbia County. The military budget, again, I have here inspiration. Where have the flowers gone? I was at Pete Seeger's house. I've known her for over 30 years on Friday morning. And I think one of the reasons why I have the support of so many longtime community activists, committed folks like Pete Seeger, is I want to stop the war machine. Enough is enough. You know, I don't know why. Look, I'm voting, believe it or not, probably everybody in this room does not think that I'm voting for Barack Obama this year, but he got the Nobel Peace Prize after sending 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Up is down, and down is up. You know, it's just, it really doesn't make any sense. Also, I do want to give Julian credit, because he beat me to the punch on a few other issues that I've been working long on, and actually I've been in the media on the solar issue. Germany has less sunlight than we do. They have solar panels all over the place. And on broadband, I just did a press conference a week ago up in Schoharie County in Jefferson about the telecommunications industry is making profits up the yin-yang. There's no reason why everybody should not have broadband. And I'll talk a little bit about farming later, if it's okay with Mr. Lynch.
As I promised, you'll get 3 minutes at the end to talk about whatever you want to talk about, even the weather. And Mr. Sherman.
Thanks. Look, let's speak seriously for a minute here. As long as we're repeating this, Julian worked for the CIA. Julian worked for the CIA. Yeah, I was an attorney for the Central Intelligence Agency, a civil servant, a nonpartisan public servant, working to help protect and defend the United States, including by helping bring Al-Qaeda terrorists to justice in our civilian criminal courts where they should be. And the issues that Mr. Tyner raises about abuses at the Central Intelligence Agency and elsewhere arise at the policy levels of George Bush and Dick Cheney, where they should be, and two people who shouldn't have been there. So my role as a lawyer was to ensure that that agency followed the law. That was the mission that I believe in and support. So let's talk now about what we can really do. And I can assure you that I'm not a lapdog for anybody, but I will be a watchdog for the defense and national security budget, and it's an area I know a little something about. And let's give it a quick example that we saw in the news just recently. We all know how hard it is to find funding for science in America. NASA's been trying to replace the Hubble Space Telescope, can't do it. Well, who knew? The National Reconnaissance Office, a little known agency in the national security establishment, had two Hubble-class telescopes sitting in a warehouse that it had never gotten around to launching into space. Who was watching the budget when they asked for those without looking at whether they were even going to be used? That's the kind of waste that drives Americans crazy, when we could have had advances in scientific research, but our intelligence apparatus asked for things they didn't need and got them because no one was paying attention and there to say no. Well, I'll be there to watch. I'll know the difference. I'll know where to look, and I'll make a difference.
Henry Muller, the Medicare has a little problem in the future of finances. How would you solve this problem?
Thank you. You actually gave me a great opportunity to continue the story that I began in answer to an earlier answer, which was that Medicare was wonderful to me and my family when we needed it, with the exception of the prescription drug benefit, which is, as a lawyer, you know, the thing was written by lawyers. I thought I'd have a leg up figuring the thing out. But sitting around the kitchen table with my dad and trying to figure out what thing we would choose when all we really wanted to choose was being able to have coverage for the drugs, was insane. And when you look at that, what you see in it is a gimmick that caused us a huge budgetary problem. And it's the first thing we could fix to put Medicare on firmer foundations, something that in Congress could do immediately. And that's allow Medicare to negotiate with the big pharmaceutical companies, which as a result of the Bush administration's initiative was written into law that they could not do, costing us tens of billions of dollars every year over time. So there is one concrete step right off the bat to reduce what are the costs of Medicare. But on top of that, here's what we know about Medicare. It's the most effective health insurance plan at controlling costs. So the issue isn't so much how you control the cost of Medicare. It's how do you control the escalating cost of health care. Medicare does a pretty good job of reining its costs in relative to other health insurance. But it's those escalating costs of health care, the over testing, overuse, overdriving of many in that health insurance driven area that is driving costs upward. And so Medicare is obviously a part of that solution. And there are things we can do to improve Medicare, but we need to fix the larger picture too.
Thank you. Today's New York Times, the editorial, Fiscal Cliffs notes, and it talks about the need for quote unquote entitlement reform. And I have 99% on my purple and white lawn signs, you know, purple and white, red and blue mixed together, postpartisan. I have 99% on the lawn signs because Michael Moore said this in Madison, Wisconsin last March. The richest 1% of people in this country have more wealth than the other 150 million of us combined. There should be no budget cuts. You know, I actually walked because I knew that Andrew Cuomo was going to do great things for marriage equality. But even the New York Times in May of 2010 was telling us that Andrew Cuomo was going to give us the shaft when it came to the property tax cap, the millionaire's tax, and funding for our schools. So I walked 12 days, 140 miles in the hot sun, if you didn't read yesterday's Albany Times Union, from the New York Stock Exchange in New York City up to Albany 2 years ago, because FDR did not get us out of the depression with budget cuts, layoffs, and union busting. There's no reason at all whatsoever to cut Medicare. Julian Tribin knows it's a great program. I don't know why, again, and I'm asking you folks to wake up if you haven't woken up yet. For decades, you've had an incredible congressman named Maurice Hinchey, who has been fighting for Medicare for all. Max Feinstone, Connie Holland, Paul Miller, they're not here anymore. I'm here. Art Richter points out that Medicare, the overhead of Medicare, is actually less money, national, than what the HMOs, the overhead, is just for New York State alone. All right? So I would just say that we don't need to cut Medicare at all. And I would be a principled, very strong voice. That's why we're doing a press conference, actually, today. We're doing a rally in front of the FDR site. I invite you all to join me on Route 9 in Hyde Park, because it's atrocious what too many Republicans and Democrats have put Medicare and Social Security on the chopping block.
We'll take one more question. The lady in the back, please.
My name is Jean McAvery. I'd like to know what your position is on Medicare reimbursement for integrated modalities of healthcare. For example, acupuncture, massage therapy, and that type of care.
I'm all for that. Look, I'm not going to lie. My parents were hippies in the 60s, all right? So There's all sorts of alternative healing ways, and long ago we should have made sure that they're all legally covered. Under current, you know, reimbursements and under single-payer Medicare for All. It's funny, you mentioned the Medicare reimbursement ratio. That reminds me of, there's been a lot of media coverage of, I think, Stephen Lundquist, the head of the New York the Health Alliance, and, you know, the Kingston Hospital. And again, David Lundquist, excuse me. Well, I was actually there at the Holiday Inn in Kingston for the Chamber of Commerce presentation. And Mr. Lundquist said something very curious. I don't know if anybody in the media picked it up. He talks about, I think, the Center for Medicare Services, or CMS, basically. He was able to convince them that it's ridiculous that you folks here are discriminated against. Hospitals in Ulster County have this crappy reimbursement ratio, while the ones in Dutchess. The reason why I bring this up is Lundquist mentioned the current political environment. The current political environment made it impossible. What's the current political environment is one where even Paul Krugman on August 1st last year said that basically it was abject surrender and capitulation that Obama did to the Tea Party. Where even Bill Clinton and Katrina VandenHeuvel were talking about all these different ways to raise the debt ceiling. So I'm just saying that I'm not go along, get along. I never have been, never will be. And the reason why, you can ask Mr. Gibson this next time, or too many Democrats who are afraid to raise hell with Barack Obama, the reason why we don't have the current political environment to make sure that Kingston and Benedictine Hospital can stay open, and that schools in Dutchess and Ulster County aren't shutting down, is because too many Democrats are afraid to speak truth to power to Mr. Cuomo and to Mr. Obama.
It's straightforward. Medicare should cover what works to make people's health better and make their lives better. And if there's doubt about what that is, we should be supporting research to ensure that we know what's making people's lives better and the quality of their lives better. We know that the cost of healthcare is driven by end-of-life costs in the last few weeks. We know that many forms of traditional medicine are very expensive relative to the things that you were describing. So when we talk about a crisis of medical care costs, we need to look at alternative ways to treat people, to bring them to a period of health, not sickness, and to improve the quality of life. And so Medicare shouldn't be discriminating against things that work, and we should ensure that we're doing everything we can do to know what works so that we can support it and can make the quality of life better.
Thank you. Now we're going to get summary comments from each candidate. Before we get to do that, I want to thank the audience for its courtesy and attention. I also want to remind you all that there is an election tomorrow, and a budget election tomorrow for the Highland and New Paltz school budget. So that's something to attend to. Highland, I think both tomorrow. Okay, so people, so you should immediately attend to filing for an absentee ballot if you wish to vote in the primary, and Dorothy has those. Dorothy can help you with your absentee ballot. Okay, now I think Mr. Sharma, you started out, so I think I'm going to turn to Joel here for 3 minutes. Mr. Tyner.
In spite of my being a little bit ornery, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Benjamin, and thank you, Julian, Mr. Schreiben, for this opportunity. Look, I've been a community activist for 20 years. Honestly, I never even expected necessarily I'd get elected to anything. I was after, you know, but I got elected in 2003. I got reelected 4 times, actually, even in the middle of my 5th term, believe it or not, serving the Dutchess County Legislature, Rhinebeck and Clinton, where, yes, there have been Republican town supervisors named Jeff Burns and Thomas Trout. So I know you may be thinking, how did this guy get elected in 2 towns, 5 times, where there have been Republican town supervisors? And at the risk of seeming like the most egotistical person in the world, it's because people believe in me. It's like Maurice Hinchey. You have a choice, right? You have a choice to send somebody to Washington who's gonna pick up the torch. Maurice Hinchey has that torch there. taking on the HMOs in the insurance industry and big pharma, single-payer Medicare for all. With all due respect, Julian's not carrying that torch. Let's bring back FDR's Glass-Steagall Act, break up the big banks, tax Wall Street speculation. Well, Maurice Hinchey, Elizabeth Warren, John McCain, I started a petition 4 years ago to bring back FDR's Glass-Steagall Act, break up the big banks, separate commercial banking from investment banking, stop them from speculating with their savings. I don't hear him talking about that. Those are two big Maurice Hinchey issues. I didn't make them up. Why isn't he talking about that? And on the fracking issue, I'm sorry, but with all due respect, I don't think, Julian, that you've seen that movie. That's my gift this afternoon. It's a movie called Gasland by Josh Fox. Don't believe me. Confirm it, verify it for yourself. Go to WAMC's website, Google it, Yahoo, search it, whatever. April 17th, Alan Chartok asks Julian about fracking, and Julian says, in terms of the impact, I think the jury's still out. Period. Ipso facto, you're losing the primary on that. I'm sorry. Because there's been game, even in yesterday's Albany Times Union, there's more quotes where it's more waffling. People don't like that. People want a clear, cogent, strong response. I'm asking you folks to work with me to send me to Washington. People are tired of the sick old, same old, same old. There's been, I'm not going to say their names, but there's so many county Democratic chairs. I wasn't even allowed to speak before the Ulster County Democratic Committee. And I'll say something else. The American Association of University Women has organized a number of debates. He's too busy for them. On April 20th, I sent an email letter saying, please, you know, there's 8 weeks to go before the June 26th primary. Don't you think the people in 11 counties deserve public debates? But I've been treated like a little, you don't have any money. I'm sorry I don't have any money. Is this what the Democratic Party's become? Apparently so. Well, I will be at those debates. And we're talking about tomorrow at 5 p.m. at Rhinebeck Village Hall, Wednesday 3 p.m. at Woodstock Community Center, and Wednesday 4 o'clock at New Paltz Village Hall, and also tomorrow in Rensselaer County. And you need to be there, Julian. You need to be there. And you have disrespected me. You lost the Democratic majority in the Ulster County Legislature, and I'm elected 5 times in a row. You have disrespected me, sir. Show up for those debates.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, again, for moderating. Thank you, Dorothy, for organizing. Thank you all for coming today and giving me an opportunity to speak about why I'm running for Congress and why it's so important that we win this election. My family's been represented by Congressman Hinchey since I was 2 years old. I know what his legacy is, and I know the work that he's calling upon us to follow. But we are now running in a brand new swing district with a Republican incumbent. We've never been in this situation before. The consequences of this election are critical. We have a congressman now. We are inheriting a congressman who's voted to end Medicare as we know it. Done that already. Voted to defund Planned Parenthood. Done that already. Voted anti-choice every chance he could get. Done that already. Plans to keep doing it. And if we don't beat him this year, we aren't going to. I offer you something different. I offer you a strong platform of values, of fairness for all people, of inclusiveness for everyone in our American family, and for rebuilding jobs and the economy in this region, focusing on the small businesses and focusing on our families. And let me say this, you've heard from me a lot today, and you've simultaneously heard from someone telling you what I would say. So let me correct one fact, and you can go out and find that you can correct a lot of other facts. I've been in favor of putting Glass-Steagall back for years. I've talked about it for that time. I put out a statement clearly on my website not long ago, a few weeks back, clearly supporting returning us to Glass-Steagall. So don't let's listen to what the campaigns are saying. You haven't heard me talk a lot about what his positions are. I let Mr. Tyner do that. And you've heard me talk about what my positions are and what my values are. We've built a campaign with tremendous grassroots support across this district. Tremendous support from folks like Planned Parenthood, from folks like the labor movement, who know that I will be a champion for working people in these communities. It's where I come from, it's what I believe, it's where my values are. And I will beat Chris Gibson and put an end to the Tea Party influence in this region. So thank you again for this opportunity. I look forward to continuing this conversation over the remainder of the primary period. We're going to be all over the district, and we're going to be talking to voters everywhere. We look forward to being here and talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you all for joining us today. Thank you, gentlemen, for this debate. Mr. Chargan will have to leave. Mr. Tyner will be, I understand, will be staying. Thank you very much.
Hey, it's Cassie.
Hey, it's Shelby, and we're from Chatham.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM.
Thank you, Cassie.
Listener-supported hands-on radio.
For Greene and Columbia counties. Have a nice day.
Yay!
The Mountaintop Arboretum, a unique nature sanctuary in the heart of the Catskill Mountains, invites residents and visitors to gather for the 11th annual Garden Fair at the Arboretum on Saturday, June 30th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. This year, guests are invited to take guided nature walks through two of its areas, the West Meadow and the Woodland Walk, both featuring distinctive terrains. Admission will include special gardening demonstrations, an art show presented by the Wyndham Arts Alliance, refreshments, and the opportunity to purchase hardy native trees and shrubs. For more information, visit their website at www.mtarboretum.org.
WGXC founding underwriting support is provided by High and Mighty Therapeutic Horseback Riding and Carriage Driving, Ghent, New York, serving children and adults with special needs. For more information, applications, or to volunteer, call 518-672-4202 or online at high-n-mighty.com.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today it is an honor and privilege to welcome Amy Califa. She is the producer of the award-winning documentary Two Angry Moms and most recently the author of Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. Amy, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Linda.
We met on a super shuttle. We were both going to the Greening Schools National Meeting, and I had seen your film, but we had all of this windshield time to talk about our combined work, and I knew that I wanted you to be a guest on my program. Your documentary, Two Angry Moms, we should probably talk a little bit about that and how you became interested in school food.
It was kind of an evolution for me. You know, it started out as just a personal kind of story where I had my own issues with, you know, some chronic health issues, migraines and allergies and things like that. And I learned over time that what I ate really influenced my health, and then raised two healthy daughters and brought them up on, you know, as healthy a food as I could provide for them, mostly organic. But of course, you know, they're kind of, they eat whatever. They like their junk food too. But it was always kind of I felt like it was my secret life, my food world, and it didn't really intersect at all with my professional world. I'm a filmmaker, and it was kind of something that I couldn't talk about in that world. And sometimes I would propose, like, hey, how about if we make a movie on food and health and politics? And it just wasn't sexy, really, until the headlines from the CDC came out stating that this is the first generation in our nation's history that is predicted to live shorter lives than their parents. And I said, you know, I really need to do something about this. And I decided I would make a movie, and various things happened that were just wonderful coincidences that led me to focus on school food. And I realized this is an educational issue. What's going on in schools? What are kids not just being fed, but what are they learning about food? And I was frankly pretty shocked when I found out. And then it was just all about timing. As I made the movie, suddenly this started to become a headline issue, and what I thought would be just a little documentary turned into a pretty big topic, really, and it's kind of kept me going ever since. So the movie came out in 2008, and I'm still in the school food world.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you talk about how you became an angry mom. You visited your daughter's school. You found out what she was eating instead of the lunch that you typically packed for her. And you found out.
That was, I think, kind of every parent's dismay. Right. You know, you work hard to pack a healthy lunch. And when I went to, my daughter was in middle school. She's now in college, and she still hates it when I tell this story, but hopefully she's not listening. I asked the food service director at her school if they could show me how the lunch system works. They have a computerized system, and a lot of schools have this now. And I was not aware, and I bet a lot of parents don't know still, that you can actually get a readout of everything your child has purchased in the cafeteria. Now, we had put a little bit of money on account for her for the days that she forgot her lunch or she wanted a little something extra. And when she did the readout for my daughter, I saw that on a daily basis she was purchasing chips and fries and Rice Krispie treats and Pop-Tarts, things that I really didn't even know they were selling every day at school. And so that ended up being the first scene in the movie of my surprise at my child's lunch check. And you know, it's something that every parent needs to know about, and that you can go to school, you can see what your child is eating, and I urge parents to go and have lunch with their kids and really experience the food in the cafeteria. It's an important first step.
Absolutely. And you also quote Senator Tom Harkin in your book. And I love this quote because he comes out and he says, we've got these cartoon characters selling poison. He calls junk food poison. And he says, because that's what this food does. It poisons our kids. And you describe how schools undermine, really, parents' best efforts by having these foods available. You have some statistics about how many parents say that they really don't like the school food or the foods that are offered. So you've got a statistic where 75% of parents think that the food offered at school is not very nutritious, and yet 45% of children buy school lunch at school, plus these a la carte items, and you talk about the disconnection there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the a la carte is supposed to be changing based on the new federal guidelines that are going into place this year, which means that it's supposed to be held to the same standards as the what we call the subsidized lunch, or, you know, what's commonly known as the hot meal. But if parents aren't aware of what the kids are consuming and they don't bring it to the awareness of school administrators, then everybody's going to turn a blind eye because there's so much rationalization in the school lunch program. You know, it's, if you talk to a food service director, they're going to say, well, we don't have enough money and we have to sell the junk food in order to break even on the lunch program because we don't get any other funding from the district. You know, you're going to hear all kinds of rationalizations like that. And as you know, what Senator Harkin said is there's absolutely no excuse, and I agree with him, for offering bad foods to kids. And so I went looking for solutions, and that's really what the movie and the book are all about, are what are districts that are paying attention to this, what have they done, how have they made these changes, and how are they making it work? And it can be done when you focus on the issue. So that's the really most important thing, is to make this become an important issue in your community, in your school district, and then the change can happen. You know, it's like bullying in some districts has been a big issue, and there are all these consultants that come in and they train teachers and they work with the kids and they do assemblies to raise awareness about this as an issue. So we have to see this as important, as dangerous as, you know, something like bullying or pesticides on playgrounds. You know, these things that have made headlines, school food is as important. It's just maybe more insidious.
Well, now the Institute of Medicine has come out. I guess maybe they do a report every 5 years. I know there was one in 2006 that had looked at childhood obesity. Now we've got another one coming out talking about, you know, the whole weight of the nation issue and how are we going to address the tragedy of childhood obesity, which, as you say, is going to lead to shorter lives of our children, the most important people in our lives, really. And the recommendation is that because children spend so much time at school and they receive at least a third of their calories from the school meals, that the schools should be a focus of change. And so I can't imagine a better tool to use in making school change than your book, Lunch Wars. It's really a guide. As you say, you include case studies, you include quotes from wonderful people who have made changes. It's a guide to how to.
Yeah, I tried to write it as a handbook. You know, there's 9 chapters, and it's sort of the kind of book where you could jump to the chapter that interests you, whether it's policy or school gardens or farm-to-school programs. You know, it's organized so that things are focused by topic, or, of course, you can read it cover to cover because I interspersed a lot of these inspiring stories throughout. But I think what the Institute of Medicine is seeing is, you know, as an important educational setting, schools to teach kids, it's really part of, I guess I would call it a holistic approach, that you have to not just feed kids differently, better, real, whole foods. You also have to teach them about the importance of food, not only on their health, but as a cultural value. If you look at a school lunch menu from France, I don't think anybody in this country would believe that's really what kids eat. There's a woman, American woman, who's doing, I can't remember her name now, but she's doing a wonderful blog on school menus from France, and they have a 4-course meal, you know, little kids on a daily basis, and it's all really what we would consider gourmet food. So they consider this very important to educate a child's palate, and it's a cultural value, and we need to at least